I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Division to order. And Representative Kalen, you want to move the minutes to March 18th?
I will.
Chair? Representative Kalen, move the minutes to March 18th. Any corrections or not? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The minutes are approved. We're going to go out of order because some of the members have bills somewhere else and they got to chase them back and forth. So we'll take Representative Morrow's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move House File 4100 and thank to Representative Kalen and his testifiers for allowing us to switch order here.
All our bills go to finance for the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So you moved your bill. Okay, thank you.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, House File 4100 gets to a problem, members, that we heard about in committee earlier, and that's why Ms. McCormick is with me today. This is about the BVS computer system. We've heard how antiquated this computer system is. We heard last year as well, and I imagine for members who've been here for a while, you've heard about this year after year. Everything from delays in processing titles, driver's license. Ms. McCormick and I talked about the problems at traffic stops in terms of instantaneous check on license and the like. And so, members, I bring this bill that would increase various registration, license, and titling fees by $1.75. I don't like the idea of increasing a fee, but I don't like the idea of having an antiquated computer system even more. This amount would be collected over years. The amount that you heard about last week or so was $12 million or so a year for the next 4 years. I think it's now $12.25 million a year. And I can defer to Ms. McCormick to ask questions about the needs of the computer system, but I also know that members have heard a great deal about this. We did, members, allocate money for pre-design of the computer system in the 2007 session.
Representative Morrow, where did that money come from? Would you explain that to me?
The money for the pre-design, Mr. Chair, to be honest, I don't recall where that money
came
from.
Trunk Highway Funds.
Oh, thank you. From Trunk Highway Funds. Members, the governor had proposed spending $12 million a year over the next 4 years out of Trunk Highway Funds. My concern is that that money should be used for roads and bridges, and this is a rational relation test for me. It's rational related that the relationship here is if the computer system is used for fees and registrations, it should be paid for by fees, licenses, and registrations.
Representative Morrow, there's an amendment. You want to move that? Is that your amendment?
I don't believe that's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
You want to move that amendment now?
Yes, I'd like to move that the amendment.
On page... Nelson moves HDA 562.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nelson.
And on page 3, line 36, it's just insert after the period, of which one component allows law enforcement access to information on motor vehicle insurance status. I remember a few years ago we had a big to-do about letters going out to individuals and that were false and people getting pulled over that had insurance and people that don't have insurance, and this would allow that allow the law enforcement when they stop somebody to have that if it's in a computer. And while they're designing a new system, I'd like to have that put in there for comfort.
Representative Morrow, you have any comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I know this amendment information came to me fairly recently, and I know that Representative Nelson has been more conversant. I don't have a particular view, but Ms. McCormick may. That's our brief conversation here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And as you may remember, in 2006, DVS and the Department of Public Safety, of which we're a part of, completed a report to the legislature on the need for an electronic insurance verification system. And we found in meeting with representatives of the insurance industry as well as other stakeholders that that it would be that in requiring an electronic verification of insurance would not make much of a significant difference in the number of uninsured motorists. We're, Minnesota is one of the lower rates of uninsured motorists of any state in our area. We're at around 10% uninsured motorists. And we found in our report that electronic insurance verification systems that have been in place have had multiple problems. They have not significantly made any difference in terms of decreasing the number of uninsured motorists. I'd be glad to send that report again to all the members of this committee for your review, but that would be our issue with it. I don't think that we would be able to substantially make this kind of a change quickly in terms of designing the information system. Certainly it can be something that's looked at in terms of our business process reengineering, but I think that the issue is more whether the electronic insurance verification systems are really effective at reducing the rate of uninsured motorists.
I wonder, Ms. McCormick, I don't think that's probably as critical as the fact that I know there's a real problem when people got stopped and they had insurance or they didn't, and that's probably more of a problem than trying to reduce the uninsured motorists, because I don't think you're going to do it in that respect. But aren't there 12 states that have this language now, or how many states have it?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm not sure how many states. I'd have to get back to you on it. It may be around, in terms of an electronic process, 12 may be high, but it's 10 or 12 maybe that are, there's a few states that are working on one right now, Texas being probably the largest state that's working on one right now.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're designing a new system, I'd like to have this designed into it. The other piece of it is, right now as people get stopped, if they don't have the card with them, now they've got to go home or find the card, and they got to appear in court. It would save some time and expense in the court system, and I think it would be a cost-saving method, you know, overall, that if they can verify electronically that, yes, they reported to have it, they may not have the card with them, and it'd be a way that I think it would save some hassle of individual citizens are having to go into the court system later on. And Hennepin County Justice Coordinating Commission has suggested this, and so that's why I'm bringing it forward.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, or Ms. McCormick. Is there a state database of car insurance information held? Does anybody hold that right now? I mean, it's my understanding that this database doesn't exist.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, no, there is no database, and so we need to rely on people bringing in their insurance information, which they could bring in at the time of registration, but they may cancel it the next day, and so that's, or they may change because of wanting a better rate, and so that's one of the issues and one of the concerns with the way the system operates. And I think that it would be valuable for you to review, for the committee to be able to review our report, because we try to show various states and some of the issues that have come up, and we did take some time to study those states and how they operate and try to, it certainly is something that all states are trying to comply with and ensure that we're administering the law, but it's very difficult because it's difficult also because insurance companies would prefer to have one system where they would not have to provide information to various states and the different types of methods that they want to use to keep the data.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then this, I guess, would be for Representative Nelson. How do you envision this database being compiled, and who would it be, Department of Commerce, or who is going to be responsible for the continual update and maintenance? Is it going to be the individual's responsibility to notify this database holder if they change companies, or is this going to be a mandate on insurance agents or insurance companies? I mean, how do you envision this database of auto insurance to be maintained?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess right now the insurance companies have to send us a cab card when we get insurance, and if they're notifying us, to notify the state or the DVS, to put it in the system. I mean, other states do this. I've got indications from auto insurers that that when they testified in Commerce that they'd support this as long as it's compatible with other, what other systems, states have systems, so that they're not having, you know, 50 systems, and it's something we could work with, and I guess that's where I'm coming from on it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
any other?
Mr. Chair, I think that there's not enough, I mean, I think that the language that Representative Nelson wants us to adopt here to this bill doesn't contemplate the fact that there isn't such a database or the cost associated with or the responsibility for maintaining. And so I guess I'm a little concerned. I think what you're trying to do is good, but I'm not so sure that your amendment may be more damaging to the system as a whole, given that we haven't provided enough structure or background for. I mean, I certainly don't want DVS's resources spent inputting a bunch of insurance data. For what purpose if it's not going to increase compliance? But, I mean, I understand the problem, but I'm not so sure your amendment gets at the solution.
Ms. McCormick, as you read line 36 and you put this to it, when you read the whole paragraph, 334 and 336, it just says it is mandated, but it says you should consider it in the research of the development of your system. That wouldn't be seen to be online. If it doesn't work, it wouldn't work. I wouldn't do it. Would I be reading that correctly then or not?
There's more. Money account must be used.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I guess the legislative intent, you know, from what Representative Nelson is saying, his intent would be that it be part of the system. I don't know. I'd defer to counsel, I guess, on that.
It would appear, though, when you read the whole section that it's part of, that it would be part, you're going to develop a system. Wouldn't that be correct? You don't have it yet. You're developing it. So, Mr. Burris, you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair and members, my read of the amendment is that it would add to the requirements on the research and development side of the information system that it includes a capability. So, you know, the database would have fields, for instance, that would allow the system to include vehicle insurance information.
Any further questions or comments? Did you have a comment, Ms. McCormick?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have an idea of the cost?
You got fiscal note in your packet.
But I mean of the amendment.
Well, I don't think it, well, it's part of the research. It doesn't show a cost. Ms. McCormick, would you comment on that? Or
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's another bill that talks about an insurance verification system. But that would not be as part of the system, but that cost of that was, I think, over $30,000, but it may be even more than that. I think that was the programming cost for that, but I may be wrong. We've been doing so many fiscal notes, but it is there is a bill right now that's in the House that does have a fiscal note attached to it.
Representative Morrow, is there a companion in the Senate that's moving?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair?
Is there a companion bill in the Senate that's moving?
There is a companion bill with Senator Olsen. I must add, I'm not sure whether this language appears in Senator Olsen's bill or not. I was just looking through my folder. I don't have a copy of Senator Olsen's bill.
Any further questions or comments? If not, all in favor of the amendment, was it 526? Or 562? Dyslexia is what I got. All in favor say aye.
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 Contrary?
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Now we're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You have a letter of from the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, also prepared to testify, but did put a letter in the packet on supporting this notion of upgrading, improving the DVS computer system.
Was just a support letter. They didn't care. Because they had the letter, they didn't they felt they didn't need to testify.
Well, there is someone here if anyone had any questions, but in the interest of time, right. Mr. Chair, we did put that letter into your packet.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Weinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know that lines 34 through 36 caught my attention as well as Representative Nelson's, and I just had a question for Ms. McCormick about that. To what extent is, or you could maybe explain the parameters in which this new account will be used to implement the Real ID program, which is, you know, an unfunded mandate from the federal government, and I guess to what extent is this, do you envision this related to that particular program?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I think the major way that it would be related would, at this point in time, basically this project would allow us to be able to have a relational database so that we can communicate with other systems, whether it be the Real ID Act or the programs that are currently required in terms of voter registration, the Help America Vote Act, where we have to communicate with through AmbaNet to the Social Security Administration to verify Social Security numbers. I think the issue for us is that most programs now and many of the things that would lead to efficiencies would be for us to be able to do more verification electronically rather than manually, and that goes for just working with our own court system, which is difficult at times where we have to do things manually versus an electronic verification of information.
Representative Hornstein.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would be the, you know, even given implementation of this, do you know approximately what the state's liability to implement Real ID would be minus whatever you would get out of this bill?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, not to look back here on my facts with the Real ID Act, but basically, I think it may decrease some of the costs that we've associated with our one-time costs, so obviously it would decrease those costs some, to some degree. I think that right now the National Governors Association, the National Council of State Legislatures, and the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators have been very consistent working together and making it known to the Department of Homeland Security and to Congress that they're expecting that the federal government pay the costs associated with coming into compliance. So obviously it could be that at some point in time that may decrease some of the costs that we're listing right now for us to come into compliance with the Real ID Act, but there are also substantial costs related to the fact that just this would allow us to start communicating with other systems, but there will be costs associated with Real ID in terms of verifying information. Every time you verify a Social Security number, immigration, there will be a cost associated with those, that matching and verification going on. So those are some of the costs that we've listed when we gave you that information about the Real ID Act. Some of that is just the costs associated with the millions of hits that we have to make against those systems, and looking at costs associated with probably working through some kind of hub in order to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Real ID, whatever. That is not mentioned in any way. Has this got something to do with compliance? There's no compliance in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the design of this bill was to address the need that DVS had identified in terms of needing a new computer system. My concern was that we not take money from roads and bridges to do it, but rather do it from an alternative source, a source closely related to the service being provided.
Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, the Deputy Mayor, is this amount of money that we're showing on the fiscal note here, is that going to terminate after 3 years because you'll have the system up running and installed and so forth, or this ongoing? Is this enough money in 3 years to accomplish whatever it is we're trying to accomplish, a new tech?
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, my understanding in talking with DVS is that this would raise a sufficient amount of money in the years outlined here. At the end of that time, I think a future legislature has to ask itself, will there be monies needed to maintain the system, to upgrade the system, and at that time, the future legislature might either choose to sunset the $1.75 technology fee or to continue it for further purposes. But I leave that door open.
Ms. McCormick, do you want to comment?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the plan, as I think I mentioned last week when we were talking about it, that we have a 4-year design plan. So it would go an additional year than what's shown. Our fiscal note just goes out for the next biennium. So it would be a 4-year design plan. At that point, we would be able to retire the other system. And then there would probably be maintenance costs. We know there'd be ongoing maintenance for that system. At this time, we don't have an exact estimate on what that estimate is. We've looked at something close to, around $7.6 million that may be needed for ongoing system development, but obviously at that point in time we'll be keeping the legislature informed as we're working on this process, and we would be able to come back and report to you and determine what kind of funding we would need for maintenance. But the actual project to design is $48 million, so that would be $12 million for each of 4 years.
Well, there must be some money set aside for the maintenance of your present system. Whatever happens to that?
Right now, Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, right now our current operation budget for our maintenance of our system is $1.6 million. The cost of operating our system right now is $4.9 million. And so what we've had to do is we've had to utilize grant funding. We've had to utilize additional money that we haven't been able to use in other ways. And we've also had to use some department money as well so that we've been able to operate and maintain our current system.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, on along the lines of following the money here, and you may have explained this. I apologize if you did. For example, on page 1, 119, 120, the first question I have is, the money that's collected now, 6.25, 3.25 of that goes into the vehicle services operating account. Where does the balance of it go, the other $3? And I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, I think the money is divided between the general fund for titles. I think this is under the title. It's under the general fund and the highway user fund, if I'm not mistaken. I may have to defer to Department of Finance, but that's my understanding.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I was under the impression anything to do with license and registration was dedicated money. If that's going to the general fund, that's interesting. My second question then.
Representative Beard. Representative Beard, if I could just check, maybe this page, you know what the high school.
Is that?
Okay, Representative Beard.
Okay. I'm judging the hand signals in the audience.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, from our finance director, it is general fund money. The rest of the money goes to the general fund.
Well, then that perhaps, Mr. Chairman, will answer my second question, because I noticed we're raising the fee $1, Representative Morrow, but we're asking that $1.75 in additional money be paid into the technology account. So are we taking all the dollar of the increase plus 75 cents for transfer from the general fund? Is that where that's coming from then? Which, just, oh, by the way, would be fine with me. I just want to be sure we weren't taking it from roads and bridges.
I hear some movement behind me, Representative. Someone who may be coming down to answer those specific questions, if I might.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in consultation with our finance director, Frank Ahrens, he's thinking that there may have been an error in the drafting, because it should be that it should have gone up $1.75, so that the $1.75 would be the part that would be paid out to the technology account.
Where would the change?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, what I'm hearing is that at line 1.19, you are correct. The number 7.25 that's been inserted should actually be $8. It should be a $1.75 increase.
Okay, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
If you look up on line 1.11, it does clearly state in the beginning of your bill. The surcharge should be $1.75. We just didn't do the math. No.
There are additional spots, members. Mm-hmm. Example on line 2.4. Again, it shouldn't be. Should be. Now we're challenging the $7.25, not $6.50. Members on line 2.9.
Mm-hmm.
It should be $9, not $8.25.
Representative Morrow.
Yeah, right. And I would move that
Mr. Burris.
Oh.
Wear that away.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, for the oral amendment, I've got page 1, line 19, delete 7.25 and insert 8.0. Page 2, line 4, delete 6.5 and insert 7.25. Page 2, line 9, delete 8.25 and insert 9.0.
Is that your oral amendment, Representative?
That is, Mr. Chair.
You've heard the oral amendment. Any questions?
No extra charge for tripping over that.
Not all in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, the oral amendment is passed. See, further questions or comment on the bill? If not, Representative Moore renews his motion in the House file. Was it 4100? He recommend a pass and sent to Finance Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Finance Division.
Mm-hmm.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary?
No.
The House file 4100 is passed and sent to Finance. Thank you, Representative Kalin, for yielding your spot. Probably took longer than you figured.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 3301.
Okay, Representative Kalin, moved House File 3301.
And then I'd also like to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Would you want to explain the amendment, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The there are two main changes in the A3 amendment. The first is just when MnDOT notifies the chairs of the transportation committees in the House and the Senate of when they choose the design-build method and also why, that they also provide initial cost estimate, the expected timing in terms of the RFP, and then the expected stipulated fee to the losing bidders in exchange for their intellectual property, and then also requires a notification of the chairs if there's any changes to those elements of the project. And then the second component that begins on line 1.17 deals with the what we might call a cap on the difference between all responsive bidders and the winning bidder. So the winning bidder couldn't be more than 15% of the lowest price of a responsive bidder, so that we don't have a runaway project here. But and that would only apply to projects that are $10 million or more.
Any questions or comments from the committee on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment 833-0183, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? Amendment is passed. Representative Shellen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be as brief as I can for your benefit, and also I caught the capital flu over the weekend, so I'm hoping my stamina lasts here. House File 3301 is the Design Build Contracting Reform Bill. I've been working with the Association of General Contractors, been trying to work out the details with the Engineers Council, and off and on with MnDOT. We've been trying to work with them as much as possible. I think they can speak to some of the off and on nature. I'm not the biggest fan of Design Build, and I think that that if we had kept pace with all of our projects and needs around the state, I would be pushing to actually rescind the authority to use Design Build. But I think that it's, given that we're so far behind and we have so many unmet needs around the state, that it is a tool that's needed as we start to accelerate projects. And I think the news over the weekend with the St. Cloud Bridge, the Highway 23 bridge, Design Build is going to be an appropriate tool that needs to be used there. I think in light of the 35W bridge contract and the public's perception of the Design Build process, I think it's important that we tweak the tool a little bit. These are small reforms that are in the bill, and that we continue to increase public confidence in this tool. I'll just talk very briefly about what the bill does, and then leave it to testifiers and to answer questions, Mr. Chair. It's a series of small reforms, each in and of themselves. The first is as we just adopted, the communication between the agency and the transportation chairs. I think that the public deserves to know how much projects are going to cost when we're fast-tracking them. And also, I think that one of the things that we really want to encourage is the sense of partnership between the legislature and MnDOT. And I think having open communication really does that. You might hear that that the agency is a little concerned about the kind of gotcha element. I believe that, Mr. Chair, that you don't engage in gotcha politics. I believe that any chair of the Transportation Committee, an infrastructure committee, shouldn't be engaging in gotcha politics, but should be watching out to make sure that our projects are being built as fiscally responsibly and structurally responsibly as possible. And I think that communication is a key part of it. I also, the bill will also provide a record of the formal meetings between proposers and MnDOT. It'll also rein into a little bit of discretion from MnDOT when it comes to technical scores. We want the technical scores to be clear in terms of the expectations of how projects are going to be scored and how they're going to be evaluated. And then lastly, the 15% cap that we just adopted in the amendment would make sure that we don't have this broad range where the highest bidder by $57 million in the 35W bridge experience gets the project. And members, I think it's important to point out that in the experience of the design build tool, most often the lowest bidder gets the highest technical score and gets the job. I believe that that will continue to be the case, but I also think it's important that on very high-profile projects with lots of pressure, I think the St. Cloud Bridge is going to be an example of a fairly high-profile project, that we continue to make sure that there are just nice little boundaries set on the criteria and the evaluation process. You might hear the bill blows up, the statute blows up the law. It doesn't. It's actually a series of fairly minor changes compared especially to our initial conversations on what we could do with the bill. And I also would say that I wouldn't carry a bill that's going to take away any tool that is so critical for our success in investing in our roads and bridges responsibly. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe that the Association of General Contractors are here to weigh in on the bill, as well as the engineers and MnDOT themselves.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Warkey. I'm the Highway Division Director for the Associated General Contractors. We're the largest trade association in the state representing highway and general building contractors. I appreciate this chance. I'm going to give a few overview comments and be brief and try to not reiterate some things that Representative Kalin has put on the table already. But I think it's important to start this conversation for this committee to hear clearly from our membership that design build is an important tool that is necessary for us and the legislature to be successful in delivering the historic transportation funding package that just passed this body. We absolutely believe that design build can be effective and is a necessary tool. However, we have serious concerns that some modifications need to occur. Also, it's important to point out that my organization led the charge back in 2002 to pass this procurement alternative through this body because we believe fundamentally that design build did help provide value beyond just a low bid process. So the Associated General Contractors is supportive of design build. We do, however, believe that fairness, objectivity, certainty, and accountability are all necessary elements that need to be built in to the law to allow contractors to compete on a level playing field. We think the owner needs to be more descriptive, more accurate, and more direct in defining what it is they actually want the contractor to deliver through the design build best value process. It's also important sometimes in defining what we're trying to do, maybe it is easier to talk about what we're trying not to do. And as Representative Kalin pointed out, this bill we do not believe will in any way decimate MnDOT's design build program. You have in existence design build best value, and you also have design build low bid in the law. This bill in front of you deals with the best value component of the design build process. You still have the value of combining the design and the construction phase that remain untouched, that provide that value of time in delivering the project that is so important. This bill does not provide a competitive advantage to Minnesota contractors in no way. It does not impact or affect any active litigation that is currently ongoing. The committee needs to be aware that there is a taxpayer lawsuit that is out in front of the courts presently concerning the award of the 35 projects. We believe it is appropriate for this body to consider these types of changes, and it will have no impact on that litigation. It does not prevent or eliminate MnDOT's ability to obtain best value from the contractor. As Representative Kalin pointed out, it simply tries to skinny up that band that cost can play in the process. Nor does it curtail competition or render low bid as the only option. Legislation tweaks the process and makes it better by bringing marginal cost controls into the selection. With respect to the scoring, we think that it provides a fair process and it will provide an accommodation for costs to be considered within that structure. And the public will receive value in that those precious public dollars are spent wisely and are brought to bear on the project, and you can be assured then that what you are getting is actually the best value. As Representative Kalin pointed out, the highest technical score has historically led to the lowest price, and that is because the innovation that proposing teams bring to bear in their proposals often lead them to think about ways to deliver a project cheaper for the owner. So with that, we believe that Minnesota contractors have historically provided the state with high quality construction that has saved the state tens of millions of dollars over the estimated cost. There's a good competitive market here in Minnesota with a highly skilled workforce, but contractors and the public need to trust the selection process. They need to know that it's fair and objective and that they are getting the most for their tax dollars. We believe, in closing, that the modest changes presented in this bill will help reestablish those high standards. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin, I specifically have question two. Do you want to wait till all the testimony comes? I think it's better to wait till all the testimony.
I agree, Mr. Chair, and I, with that, I
think
be
available. Right.
Mr. Oxley, I think from the engineers to come forward. Is that right?
Lieutenant Nelson?
Oh, okay.
Betsy Parker? I think she's on.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting for Mr. Oxley to approach the table, I just want to thank the engineers for their time, and we've had about six or seven lengthy conversations on the bill, and I think we've narrowed down the issue with the engineers to one component I think that they're going to talk to, but I want to just thank MnDOT and the engineers and the contractors all for working together to try to continue to find consensus on as many items as possible as we go through.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Oxley. I'm the executive director of ACEC Minnesota. And we do our best to keep good relations with AGC, and we work pretty hard in trying to come together. We haven't been totally successful in that effort, but we keep on trying. And I just want to talk about the design build process. It's been pretty successful in the past. Maybe I-35 went off the rails, but looking back on the projects that have been done, it's actually seemed to have worked pretty well, and we're pretty supportive of it. And truthfully, a few years ago, ACEC was pretty much against design build, but as time has gone on, I think we've become much more comfortable with it. And I would like to thank Representative Kalin for involving us in this. We've worked with everyone trying to get this together. We've narrowed a lot of things down, but we are not in agreement on one piece of that bill. And that has to do with the technical aspects in regard to design build. Section 6 of the bill is 115% is what we're looking at. This establishes a cap on the range of prices that can be bid on a project. And we're generally uncomfortable with caps. It basically raises price in the quotation or factor. Factors such as quality, safety, and innovation really should be playing a significant role in this process. And by putting this narrow range, you're essentially putting price as a major factor in it. We need to really look at, instead of doing this narrow focus on price, is to look at what really went wrong with 35, which was scores went all over the place. And if you want to deal with statistics, the best thing that you can do is take the outliers out and make sure that the scores are relatively consistent from person to person. That would be our proposal or our suggestion for that. We will acknowledge that the movement from 110% to 115% is still an improvement from what was proposed originally. We still have a real problem with this $10 million cap or a $10 million exemption. We've discussed within our association, we have members that are playing against this. We have others that are somewhat on the fence. I think if it was $50 million or $100 million that was exempt, we'd be much more comfortable with this legislation.
Could I just interrupt for a minute? Are you speaking about present statute? Because that's not in the bill.
Well, actually, in the amendment that was just proposed, there's a $10 million exemption. Again, we've discussed the $50 million or $100 million exemption. And if I can dig through here, you know, you collect too much stuff and then you can't find anything. But I have something to pass out to the committee. Uh-huh. There it is. Too much paper. Yes, I did. This is basically a breakdown of the last six design build projects. And it shows the percentage scores since we're dealing with this 115%. Originally, at the 110%, four of the six design build projects, there would have only been one legitimate proposer because everyone else would have been exempted because they went over that 110%. With 115%, you actually pull in a couple or two or three more projects. But I think it gives you some ideas of range of the scores for the prices and gives you some chance to see how that percentage is going to play into this. Again, 115% is better. But if you look on some of these, Highway 212 would have had only one legitimate proposer because two of the proposers would have been at 116% and 117%. So that just gives you some idea of what these, how these percentages will play in to the actual selection process. But again, we're close with AGC. We're not quite there. I wish that we could work this out. I have a transportation committee that's going to meet on Thursday, and I know we'll be hashing this out further. But we do believe a higher threshold would make more sense, or you would abandon this whole direction, at least on this piece, and look at trying to get rid of outliers and use more of a statistical analysis than the technical scores. And that completes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We probably have questions we'll probably get from all the testifiers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But again, looking at this, just got a quick question. When you figure your percentages, what are you figuring them against? When you see 101 on the bottom, 101 compared to the price, where does that reflect?
It's based against the lowest.
The next lowest bidder.
Yes, the next lowest bidder, correct.
That's not really truly reflective between low and high. Then.
You are correct, Mr. Chair.
Another testifier?
I believe, Mr. Chair, that MnDOT would like to weigh in on the bill.
I didn't see her here, and that's what I was wondering.
Oh, she's here in the third row.
She's waiting.
She's wearing her camouflage today.
I think I recognize her now, Representative Kalin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. And I do have a few comments that I want to make, and they are about the bill, the amendment to the bill, which I hadn't seen until I got to the hearing room today, and about the process. There's been a tremendous amount of discussion and controversy ever since the department awarded the contract for the 35W bridge, and if it were not for that controversy, this amendment would not be here. So I feel that I need to address that as well as the bill, because the two are inextricably tied. And it's impossible to talk about the amendment without justification for it being that the department made a mistake on the 35W bridge contract, and that if the law isn't changed, we will make a mistake in the future. And I think that is something the department definitely takes issue with. First of all, I would like to say that the department has a very long history of working very cooperatively with its contractors. We do almost 200 projects a year, and I seriously doubt that you very often hear that we are in controversy with our contractors. We value the work they do. They've done wonderful work for us on many projects, and we expect that to continue in the future. The other thing is that we are in litigation. After we awarded the 35W bridge contract, we were sued, and it is said that it is a taxpayer suit, but it's not really clear who's paying for that lawsuit, and it does address the issue of whether the department followed the statute correctly and whether the department did the right thing in awarding the contract, and the cost of the contract is at issue. So although this particular sentence may not go to the heart of the litigation, if there were not an allegation that the department had done something wrong, there would not be a lawsuit and there would not be a bill. I would also, though, like to express appreciation to Representative Kalin, who has been very patient about meeting with us and hearing us out. We had a number of meetings, and he has been extremely generous with his time and willing to listen to us, and that's something we appreciate very much. We had talked about a number of the issues in the bill. I think that because the design build law was enacted in 2001, and I have encountered some questions about what is the difference between low bid and design build, and this amendment certainly raises that issue because it puts a cap on the price that we can pay. I would like to just say a few things about the difference between those two things. Historically, we have awarded our contracts through the low bid process, which means that MnDOT employees or consultants that we hire and oversee actually scope out the process, do the design right down to the last rivet on a bridge and the last stripe on a pavement project. We specify exactly how traffic will be handled and right down to every very last detail of the project, the size and shape of every sign that's erected and the placement of it. And then when we put it out for bid, the contractor goes through and prices all those items and writes down what each thing, line item thing, will cost from the grading to the final work. And we pick the lowest bid, and we make sure that they added up all the numbers properly and that they were responsive to what was requested, and it's awarded to the lowest price. When we do design build,
Ms. Parker, are you talking lowest price, or lowest bid, or lowest responsible bidder? There's a difference.
Lowest responsible bidder. On design build, we may do a very small portion of the design, which is more in the nature of a concept or the outline of something, but we do not do the actual design. In design build, the work is done by a team consisting of consulting engineering companies that actually do the design. We might tell them we want a bridge to cross this river. We want it to carry so many 100,000 vehicles a day. We give them a top estimate of what we think it might be, and we might have other parameters. We're basically defining the parameters of a project, but we don't tell them exactly what the design should be. In the case of 35W, we didn't specify whether it should be concrete or steel. We didn't tell them how many piers to put in the river. We asked them to give us their best ideas for how the bridge should connect to University Avenue on the north end of the bridge, because that was an issue very much under discussion with the city of Minneapolis and the U of M. But we didn't tell them how to do it. We just told them that we wanted some kind of design that would minimize the need in the future to do additional construction and take apart that end of the bridge to figure out how to reconnect it to Minneapolis City streets. And so in design builds, what we get from people is their good ideas, new ideas, cheaper ideas in some cases, and innovation. And it allows proposers, the team of designer, engineering design firm plus construction contract firm, to be creative and to propose something that we might never even have thought of. And that to us is the big value of design build. And that is one of the reasons that we feel that the department needs wide latitude and discretion in selecting the best project. And that is why we are nervous about a proposal that puts a 15% cap on the price. If you were to compare this to the best value contracting law that the legislature enacted last year in 2007, you would probably be shocked to see how loose the best value contracting law is. Even compared to the existing design build law, there are many things in MnDOT's design build law that define and explain how we must do it, from requiring us to use a two-stage process where we put out a request for proposals and qualify the best qualified proposers, to all of the criteria that we must have in the request for proposals. We have two requirements for notifying the legislature today. One, in advance, when we first decide to use design build on a project, we must notify the legislature. And every year we have to give the legislature a report on how we use design build that year and what the status of the project is. The law governs our payment of a stipend, requires that proposals be responsive, and something else the best value law does not do. It does not specify the criteria for the evaluation team. Our design build law says that we have to have a team and that it has to include a member of AGC, so that even the contractors have an opportunity to pass judgment on these proposals. So we are already under a much stricter regimen for picking the best value design build proposer than exists under the current law. When we were meeting with Representative Kalin and AGC, we've also met with AGC to talk about these things. We had agreed that we were willing to agree to several of the things that were in the previous bill before this amendment came. one of the things that we have always said that we would not agree to, because we do not feel we can do design build with this limitation, is the very thing that is the heart of this amendment, which is the 115% cap. And the reason for that is because we think that it severely interferes with our ability to select the best proposer. And if you looked at the seven construction contracts that we have done under design build, four out of the seven cases matched the highest technical score on the proposal with the lowest price, but three of them did not. And in fact, two of them could not even have been awarded to the proposer who got the contract if this law had been in effect then. So we would not have awarded the 212 project or the Orinoco project to the contractor who ultimately got it under our existing proposal. And there is at least two more of those contracts that were between 10 and 15%. Now you may say, well, that's not much, a couple percent. You would still have had others to choose from. But the point of this whole exercise is to choose the contractor that gives you what you think is the best value, addresses all of the particular concerns about the particular project you have. What I would like to say to you about the 35W project, in addition, is that that was an extraordinary situation. That was a tragedy that we had to deal with. We hope such a thing will never, ever happen again. But because of the nature of that project, it had to be done much faster than other projects. And when we let it, we didn't even have municipal consent. And it was not clear how we were going to get it from Minneapolis. Their biggest concern was about the design of the bridge. And the proposer to whom we ultimately awarded that contract was the proposer that found favor with the city of Minneapolis and provided the best design options for consideration by Minneapolis and the citizens of Minneapolis. That option would not have been available, and possibly we would not have gotten municipal consent had this amendment been in effect and we had been choosing a different proposer. And the other thing about this is that it's impossible to predict when you're dealing with a particular situation how it's all going to play out. And if you were a citizen of St. Cloud and you knew that we had just closed your bridge and that there was discussion in various quarters about whether we should do a design build process, which is extremely fast compared to low bid, would you like to hear that the selection of proposers was going to be determined by the 115% cap rather than by MnDOT's ability to choose the proposal that we thought was best? Maybe if you didn't live in St. Cloud, you wouldn't be so concerned, but if you lived in St. Cloud and we were building you a bridge under design build, you might want a proposal that considered the design characteristics more important than the price, as long as it was within a price that MnDOT could pay reasonably, which all of our projects have been. I have a couple handouts I'd like to give you just to address some of the concerns that have been raised lately that bring this amendment into play. And one of them is an explanation of how we handled the I-35W selection process. And this handout takes four, I think, of the criteria that we use to select the proposer. And it explains why we picked Flatiron and why we did not pick the others. It has been suggested, and it is definitely suggested in the lawsuit, that we used the wrong criteria, that we made the wrong decision, that the bidder we chose was not responsive, and that is why we need this amendment to make us address price considerations more carefully in the future. And we just simply feel that the facts, when they are examined, the cold, hard facts, show that that is not the case. And then the other thing I would like to give you is just a matrix. Oh, I'm sorry. It's just a matrix, okay, that shows all of the projects we've done to date, who the proposers were, what the department's estimate was, what the price proposals were, what the technical scores were, and what we chose.
Ms. Parker, if I may interrupt. I've given you a lot of latitude. We talked about the 35W bridge. We got a bill and I'd like to have it somewhere address that, and I appreciate that. I know that you're laying the groundwork, and it's a pretty big, broad groundwork, so I've given you a lot of latitude, and I appreciate that.
Okay. The other thing I would like to say about this is that it is directly related to this amendment and future projects is that whenever a contractor is preparing a price proposal on a project, the contractor is going to be very aware of the existence of the cap and the ceiling and is going to tailor the proposal, if that contractor wants to be the winning proposer, try and guess what other people are going to propose and then tailor it so that it doesn't exceed that. Because that's definitely what people do with low bid, and of course that's what we want them to do. The difference with low bid is that we have specified exactly what we think is the best design, the safest design, and the design that incorporates the quality that we want. In the case of design build, we are relying on the person who's making the proposal to propose things that are safe, meet quality requirements, and all of our other desires for innovation, and a project that's going to give us the best possible value. And so that is why we, the department, cannot support a proposal that puts a 15% price cap on our proposal. When we do design build, we are shifting the risk of the proposal from the department, who is not doing the design, to the design team that's going to do it. And if you look at that sheet, the matrix that I've given you, in the column that is the second column from the right, you can see that it shows estimated final cost, because when we put this together, all of our projects weren't completed. And then there's a number for some of these for cost growth. The cost growth is based on unexpected things that arise during the project that the contractor couldn't have been expected to anticipate, and that MnDOT didn't anticipate either. This is where we have to pay extra over the proposal. You can see that it's very low. It's 2.9 for Rock 52, which was our first ever design build project. And then it's 1.8, 4.6, estimated at 1%. In our low bid project, we try to keep that somewhere between 10 and 15%, and sometimes it is higher. On the 35W project, we've already had two instances where something came up that we were not aware of, where the contractor is assuming the cost in one case in particular, because the risk in design build is shifted to the contractor because they are the ones who do the design. And so we don't want them to skimp on the design and try to shift the risk back to MnDOT by coming in under this 115% cap. That's a very important element of design build. So while we understand that there's a great deal of concern about this, we feel that a closer examination of the actual facts of what happened on the 35W project and why that is a unique, unusual, probably never will happen again project makes it unnecessary to amend the statute today to address concerns about that project.
Did you have another testifier? Other than that, we'll open the question. I think...
I don't know if Mr. Allen wanted to...
Was there a Mr. Kent Allen? Otherwise, Ms. Parker, I'm sure we're going to have questions.
Yeah.
But we have another testifier.
Hello. Good afternoon. My name's Kent Allen. I work for the Department of Administration in the capacity of the Chief Procurement Officer for the state, and it's really in that role that I'm here today to provide a few comments with respect to the bill. Let me start by saying that I fully recognize that the bill is attempting to strike the appropriate balance among a number of very legitimate but sometimes competing interests. The biggest one, obviously, is how much price should matter versus how much everything else should matter. And there's no blueprint for how to do this right, but clearly price needs to matter a lot, but clearly there are other things with respect to a design build contract award that are also extremely critical. Things including the qualifications and experience of the designers, their record with respect to quality control, worker safety, various design elements, the construction timetable, impact on related roadways, environmental impacts, a number of things that need to be balanced with cost in order for MnDOT to make a selection that is in the state's best interest. The other thing that I see on the bill is an attempt to balance the competing interests between our need for a process that's relatively expeditious and one that also ensures the vendor's very valid interest in having access to relevant information and access to a full array of due process options if they believe that there's been something with the process that needs further legal analysis. So with that as kind of a starting point, let me say that specifically with respect to House File 3301, my most significant concern is the same one raised by both Mr. Oxley and Ms. Parker with respect to that 115% cap. It really becomes fairly close to a low bid process. And one of the things that I think there's some consensus on is that low bid works pretty well with commodities. Low bid works pretty well when you have clearly defined specifications for a construction process. Low bid doesn't work so well when you have really critical technical elements or when you're selecting professionals where what you're really wanting from them is their intellect and their creativity. So 115% cap isn't low bid, but it's too close to low bid, I think, to work for MnDOT. And I don't know if they could even in good conscience use the design build process if there's that strict a limitation on the range of price that they can consider. So I think, and I understand this isn't the intention, but I actually think the practical effect of the bill is that it might come pretty close to taking away the design build option from the department. Now, maybe you think that's okay because there's the design bid build alternative, and that's certainly still going to be available to them, but as you probably know, there are pros and cons to both those approaches, and one of the strong cons for the design bid build process is that it takes substantially longer and it also diffuses the accountability among more players, which isn't necessarily in the state's interest. With respect to the cap, I don't have a number to propose that I think would be a more appropriate cap. I can very quickly tell you what the Department of Administration has done with other professional technical contracts. And it's an approach that attempts to address the cost issue without setting an actual cap. What we did to sort of determine appropriate policy was survey agencies with respect to their existing professional technical contracts. State law with respect to most professional technical contracts just said that price has to be a factor, but didn't say how large a factor. And so as we surveyed agencies, we found that many agencies were actually using a price factor that was as low as 5%, and the average is about 20%. And from the admin perspective, we really thought that wasn't giving enough priority to price. So my commissioner developed the policy that says that at a minimum, price has to be weighted at 30% of the 100 points in any analysis of responses. And I'm not saying that that's the right approach to take with respect to design, build, construction, but it is one that seems to mostly satisfy the agencies with respect to getting highly qualified vendors that they're satisfied with, and seems to mostly satisfy vendors. We don't see too many protests on the results of those awards. And certainly I'm not aware of any instances when we've used this approach where there's been the kind of controversy around the price paid that developed with respect to the 35W bridge issue. Just a couple other things quickly. I have some concern about taking out the reference to when MnDOT deems a response to be non-responsive, and this may seem like kind of a semantic quibble. But I think taking out reference to the word deemed does suggest that it's a black and white determination. And I wish it was, but I can't begin to tell you how much time we spend trying to make fair and responsible judgment about which vendor proposals that we see in my department should be accepted and which need to be rejected. And clearly, if you do that, you're trying to be fair to all the vendors. You don't want to throw out a response that a vendor might have spent thousands of dollars preparing and that might actually be the best value for the taxpayer because of an inconsequential technical error that they made. But on the other hand, you need to be sure that you're not disadvantaging another responder who did actually follow all the guidelines and rules exactly the way you asked them to. So it's that kind of dilemma that makes these less black and white than we might like to believe.
Do you have much longer testimony?
About two more minutes. There's some new language in the paragraph, that, page 5, line 4, that provides some new safeguards for the responders. I think most of them are very appropriate. There's one, however, where I think the state is going too far in terms of essentially giving up what may be an appropriate right for the state to reserve, and that's the list of the three thou shalt not that are cited there. The fourth on that list is one that I would question. It's saying that the commissioner cannot attempt to shift the commissioner's costs or damages from a protest to a protester. Actually, in Minnesota, protests have always been free to protesters. There's no process through which they have to pay to engage in that process. That's not the case in some states. Some states actually make protesters file a bond or take some other action. That doesn't occur in Minnesota. But we do see instances with a handful of vendors who do clearly abuse the process. I want to be very clear in terms of making it clear that those aren't construction contractors that are involved with AGC or any of the people that we're talking about today, but a vendor who chooses to file frivolous protests can really cause a serious level of slowdown and delay and problem for the state, and I hate to see the state totally give up its right to attempt to collect damages in instances where somebody is acting in bad faith and filing frivolous protests. One final comment, I think the 7-day waiting period may be too inflexible and certainly not necessary in all cases. I absolutely understand that vendors need an opportunity to review data before they assess their options with respect to protests and litigation. And some window in which they can do that, I think, is appropriate and helpful. But an automatic 7-day window, regardless of whether anyone asks or needs one or not, to me is just not putting as much flexibility in the process as would actually serve everyone's interest. So those are my comments. Hopefully they'll be helpful to you as you further deliberate on the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kalen, what's your intent? I think we've heard a lot of testimony,
yes,
basically on both sides of the issue. You would...
I would like to move to pass the bill and send it to the Finance Committee, Mr. Chair. And one just quick closing thought. I think time is, of course, of the essence with design build and also here. I wish that Mr. Allen had actually approached me. I hadn't met him yet until right here at the table, because I think that his concerns actually would have been nice to flesh out in our stakeholder process. But I'd just like to remind the committee that NASA has a saying that build things fast, you can build them safe, and you can build them cheap. And you get to choose two of the three. I think design build goes to that, but I also think it's our responsibility that we not say that cost is not at all a factor and that we shouldn't be protecting our investments along the way. I will continue to meet with all the stakeholders and certainly will all the way through hearing it in finance and on the floor, Mr. Chair, but I do believe it's a good bill and ask for your support.
I'm aware that it needs some work, and that's what I'm kind of wondering. I think some of the issues, like you say, they may not have been addressed. I was really concerned when I saw the 115%. If I may say that sometimes there's frivolous bids thrown in, so you got to spread, and that's a real good thing for contractors. It makes somebody look pretty foolish, and I think that's a big issue we have.
And, Mr. Chair, I've actually been giving some significant pushback to AGC on that 115%, and trying to find what the appropriate
way to provide some cap in there, and I think by making sure that it's a responsive bidder, so you couldn't just have a frivolous bid in there that creates this unreasonable low denominator in there.
Or unreasonably high, too.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll take some questions, but we definitely need to move two other bills. And do we have single six? Some questions. We have Representative Hornstein and Holberg and Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if it's a question to the author or any of the testifiers, but I noticed that there's a lot of references to the Commissioner of Transportation. But, design build has been used for transit projects, most notably Hiawatha. I imagine it could be used for Central and others. Does this bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, address design build as it relates to transitways, transit projects at all?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it depends on who the owner is, and in this case, this section of law, maybe Mr. Burris could confirm this, is the section related to MnDOT. And so this only relates to MnDOT projects?
I believe that's correct.
Chapter
150. That's correct, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in other words, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, nothing in this bill would affect Met Council's ability to do design build on a future rail corridor, for example.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I believe that's correct, and I will talk to every single person I can, and if the answer comes back any different, you will be the first to know.
Okay, or second, that's fine.
Well, sorry,
thanks.
You'll be the first to know outside of me and the others I talked to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are for Mr. Werke.
Okay, Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Work, you sat up here and you said that this was not a price-fixing bill. When I look at the 115% deviation, that sounds like price-fixing to me. Convince me that you're right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I don't think I would choose to use the word price-fixing, but the process is very simple in that the existing base formula that is in law that provides for proposing teams to compete and put their proposals together and be scored on their technical merits and then open their price remains the same. So the benefit the owner gets, in this case MnDOT, from a valuable and highly refined technical proposal will manifest itself oftentimes as represented by this chart that Mr. Oxley passed out, that I should correct Ms. Parker from the department, that the 212 job was the lowest cost and the highest technical score. The point being that within that base formula, those innovations that lead to higher technical scores often lead to the lowest price proposal. So you set that aside, and then you pick up the new means test reflective of price, and you apply that and say we have an apparent winner based upon the existing formula. Now let's check their price to make sure that it remains within this cost band, and if that proposer is within 115% of the lowest responsible bidder's price, then they can get the job. And I would submit that of the jobs that MnDOT has done, save for the I-35 job, all of those have gone, and none of those would have changed under this formula. They still would have gone to the project teams that won those proposals. The 35 job, and I believe maybe the smaller job in Hawley on Trunk Highway 10 and 32, which did not go to the team with the highest score, everyone else would have stayed the same. Nothing would have changed. Those teams that did that work would have still done that work. This puts a confidence factor in there that price needs to be considered, that you cannot allow the owner to have unfettered use of price and spend those hard-earned dollars that you've all worked so hard to pass in the last 3 weeks any way that they choose because they feel that there is somehow value in that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holder.
I'm sorry, Mr. Werke, you haven't convinced me. And if we want to talk about the 35W bridge here in this document that was put out, if you're saying on your proposal, Flatiron would not have gotten the bid for 35, would you agree with that?
Correct.
All right, if you look at this document that was put together by MnDOT and you compare the geometric enhancements, the structural elements, I mean, when you have the winning bidder eliminating 5 out of 6 road deficiencies, another bidder that didn't get the bid eliminating only 1 of 6 and stating that their design was not compatible with future infrastructure needs, another bidder, again, only eliminated 1 out of 6 roadway deficiencies and showed the closure of 2 City of Minneapolis streets that was not allowed in the RFP. Are you saying that one of these 2 other bidders should have gotten the job even if they had all of these deficiencies in their bid because they didn't exceed the 115%?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, no, I'm not, because we don't believe that price then was the fundamental issue. We believe, in as it related to those teams developing their proposals, as reflected in elements of this bill, when they developed their proposal, we believe that they were not treated equally in terms of information, in terms of directness or specificity of the RFP and how that RFP was crafted.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Werke, I'm trying to get to what this 115% means. And so I'm not going to quibble about what the RFP said and whatever, but if in fact your proposal was law and there was this 115% cap, would not MnDOT have been compelled to choose one of these other bidders because of the price issue alone, irregardless of the deficiencies in the in the design? And again, you know, I'm just talking about the bid that was sitting there and your bill, how it would have affected who got the job for the I-35 bridge.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Representative Holberg, I think you can't look at it in segmented pieces. What we're trying to do, again, the direct answer to your question would be yes, that is true. However, in totality of what this bill would do in terms of some of the other safeguards beyond the formula, we believe it would level the playing field and more clearly define up front for everyone that they know the rules of the game. Those rules of the game are consistent and they are applied consistently through the process so that everyone is shooting at the same target and is then able to put their best proposal forward. With respect to the price component and the 115% cap on a $200 million job, we believe that $30 million of delta provides sufficient opportunity to bring value to the project.
And Mr. Chair, I just one other question. In here somewhere, we're going to on a fiscal note, we show paying non-public employees $15,000. I think it goes back to the compensation for the non-public employee. And I'm just wondering if, in fact, we're requiring an AGC person, would not the cost of their participation be covered by AGC?
Mr. Chair, I can actually answer that one. Representative Holberg, right now there's a memorandum of understanding between AGC and MnDOT that the $12,000 cost is split half by AGC, half for MnDOT. And so I actually do have a lot of issues with the fiscal note, but arguing between $30,000 and $80,000 or $90,000 out of the Trunk Highway Fund, that's money that is, you know, rolled into project costs and stuff. But it would be, if the MOU is continued, or the spirit of it is continued, to be a $6,000 per project cost. And they're already doing it now. It's actually one of the things that we came to. I thought that in our conversations and our stakeholder meetings, we came to an understanding.
And Mr. Chair, I have major concerns with this bill as written, and I know you want to move on, and I don't know where this thing is headed, but I think it may do just what Mr. Allen said, or might you just put an end to design build at MnDOT?
Representative Holberg, I'm correct. We have to pass the budget portion out of here today, so somehow or other we're going to get that. But, we'll see what happens here. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess some of the questions I had were asked by Representative Holberg, but I guess I just had concerns, and I guess more of a statement here that I'm not a big fan of design build, having come out of the construction trade, having worked on jobs that were design build and others that were traditional bid or design bid then build. I've seen cases where they've gone design build has cost more money, and I guess the biggest concern I have with the process that went down and what I see is the problems with the current design build statute we have in the state is the discretion and the amount of discretion in the technical scores, and you can see that with the 35W bridge that they had such a higher technical score that just blew the other two out of the water, and the price, you know, that's where the price got out of hand. Where, and like I said, that's where I have concerns with that. I have concerns with the design build, and I'm not sure if this bill goes to correct the problems I have with design build. I agree that it's a technical or it's a tool that we need to have in the box. I agree that a project like 35W or the Highway 24 bridge in St. Cloud would be projects that you'd want to have that ability to use that on, but I guess I just have concerns about the whole design build process that we have, and I'm not sure this bill corrects it, so I guess that's where it's more of a statement than a question.
Yeah, Representative Allen, my concern is too, I think we need a bill, some corrective stuff, but I don't know if this has got a ways to go or not. I mean, it's up to you, but it occurs to me we might have some problems there. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whether this is for Representative Kalin or maybe for Mr. Werke, on page 1, lines 114, 115, and again on line 1.2, audio recording of meetings with proposers. Are classified as protected non-public data, blah, 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 except that on 120, it looks like after the project's awarded, all that stuff then becomes public domain. And I'm thinking about how it's worked in the past, thinking about how we work around here, where a lot of stuff is talked about, that if we had a mic shoved in our face, we might not get a lot of things done because there is not permission to speak freely. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering here if we have people, companies, submitters coming to MnDOT, just spilling their guts, brainstorming, freewheeling, which is part of the whole creative process, the entrepreneurial spirit at play at its best. We bat things around. Sometimes we salute them. Sometimes we shoot them. You know how it goes. Shouldn't that be protected as intellectual property at some point? If somebody's going to participate in this process, would audio recordings of meetings where there's freewheeling, brainstorming going on, being made public then at the end of the day, what kind of mischief were we borrowing? Or do you actually see an upside for this that could protect us from what? I'm not seeing the upside, but share with me where this language came from.
Mr. Werke?
Mr. Werke, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, the genesis of this language, again, is to level the playing field for all proposers. There are significant and numerous opportunities as these proposals are being developed for teams to have one-on-one meetings with the owner and ask questions, and for them to also propose what are called alternative technical concepts, different ways of doing things to try to get the owner to see if they would be willing to support that. And those are often materially significant conversations to developing a proposal. The reason we have this in here is to make sure that when those questions are asked and the answers are provided, that information is shared equally and disseminated equally and answered equally for all the teams. Because there could be a question that could be asked and an answer given to one team and a
following them in the door is the next team who may not ask the questions in exactly the same way, but it is materially significant, and they get a completely different answer or some other answer, which leads them off on this path when they should be heading down the straight and narrow. So our intention with this was to provide an opportunity, not unlike the State Designer Selection Board that records their proceedings, to have, if there's an aggrieved party that feels that somehow it was unfair, that once the proceedings have concluded, they have an opportunity to exercise their due process rights by going back to see if there is something that may have been materially significant and explained in an alternative way that got them off track. That's our intention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say that there's another department, Mr. Werke, where this kind of language is already in play? And then, Mr. Chair, perhaps I'd like to hear from maybe the owner, MnDOT in this case, what their thinking is, what the effect might be on this. This is, to me, one of the more serious portions of the bill, next to the 115%. But anyhow, Mr. Werke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, my understanding, and I don't deal with this, but my understanding, and the Department of Administration may be able to tell you, but my understanding is that the proposal process of the State Designer Selection Board is recorded when those teams make their presentation. So they could probably better answer that.
Ms. Parker, coming.
Really quickly, Mr. Chair, some background on Ms. Parker's coming. We initially, Representative Beard, we initially proposed reducing every conversation to writing,
mm-hmm.
and then realized that, as happens in design bid build,
mm-hmm.
anonymous questions get asked, and then all the questions of all the teams get then disseminated, so there's, you know, level playing field, certainty, and fairness. And we don't want every single phone call, every single cell phone conversation to have to be reduced to writing. You know, we're continuing to try to narrow it and make it work. So.
Okay. Parker, do you know the question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, it's my understanding that when the Designer Selection Board has, after it receives proposals from proposers, that they haven't, when they interview the proposers, that is recorded. That is what I have been told. I don't know anything else about it from any independent study. The department does not like this provision. This is one of the three things in the bill that the department really dislikes, because we believe that the reason this is in here is so that after every award, all of the other proposers can listen to all of these audio recordings, and it provides a basis for filing protests and litigation, because it's almost inevitable that someone in MnDOT will say something to some contractor that they didn't say exactly the same way to some other contractor, and then we will have breached the requirement of fairness where we say exactly the same thing to every person. And people do ask us literally hundreds of questions during this process, and an attempt is made whenever it is seen that there needs to be something clarified about the proposal to issue something in writing to all proposers. But individual contractors ask a lot of questions, and I expect that if we were required to record every time we come face to face with someone who asks us a question, we would probably stop talking to them. We would say, submit your question in writing. If it's a significant question, we'll answer it in writing, and we'll give the answer to everyone. And as to your question about these things becoming public, contractors will talk to us about alternative technical concepts, which might be their particular engineering way of approaching some project that might not be known to someone else. At the close of the award, all of that information would become public, unless the contractor can substantiate to the satisfaction of the department that it is trade secret, that it is entitled to trade secret status under another section of the Data Practices Act. And there are very few proposals that we receive that actually rise to that level, because it has to be shown to have monetary value, and it has to have been subject to efforts to keep it secret from all other, everybody else. So it's a very complicated issue. And so when you combine that you combine the 115%, you combine the thing that is at the very heart of the litigation, which is whether or not we selected a non-responsive proposer, and this bill would change how that is looked at. The bill is clearly a problem for MnDOT, and it is very unlikely we would do design builds under this proposal. And so we would not like to see this bill move on.
Representative Kalen, this is going to drag out, I'm afraid. I wonder if the testifiers could come back tomorrow night. We have to have all bills and finance by 5 o'clock tomorrow night. We can get a room tomorrow at 2:15. I don't know if the testifiers could come back, but I believe there's probably enough questions.
If you're committing, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take your lead. I do think that, as you said, we need a bill that reforms the design-build process, and I don't want to stop the conversation here. If there are questions from members and, you know, continue to work things out, I'm happy to take your lead on this, Mr. Chair.
Unless there's a problem with the testifiers, but I didn't mean to open it up, but I think we had enough testimony without encumbering more. But also, it might give you a chance to take a look and clean up something if you want to clean it up. If that would be okay, we can lay this bill over, table it till tomorrow at 2:15.
I'm happy to do so, Mr. Chair.
And we'll have two other smaller bills tomorrow, too.
Great. So.
In room 5 tomorrow, 2:15. And thank you very much. Unless there was a question from Representative Kalen right now, we're temporarily...
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair, members.
We'll just lay, we're going to lay House File 3301 over till tomorrow at 2:15, room 5. If we can get this next bill moving, we'll take it up. Otherwise, we're going to table that. The Representative Coonan, is he in the audience? Okay. And for the members, perhaps if you could keep the data that we got with this 3301, it'll save the pages a lot of problems. Representative Coonan in House File 619. Somebody want to move the bill? Now, the chair will move the bill, and I'm understanding with the testifiers that it's going to be relatively not too long, and I think you have a testifier, I think, have a slide. Testifier indicated 10 minutes, so that sounds great. Welcome to the committee. The chair will move the bill, House File 619.
It should be
recommended, passed, and sent to finance if it does go. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All the bills are going to finance from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Conan,
and I have with me Mr. Byron Dale, and he'll go through his presentation for the committee.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dale.
Could I ask Mr. Petty to get this computer going, and I'll be right with you.
Mr. Dale, before you start, you just want to give a brief summary quickly so we know what we're going to watch, if you would.
Mr. Chairman and fellow committee members, first off, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this proposal. My name is Byron Dale, for the record. This bill is before you because several years ago, the Senate Transportation Committee, in a televised hearing, said that they needed a new and innovative way to fund transportation. And that's what started me working on this bill. And what you have here is about a 24-picture slide that I'm going to present, and I'll talk along with it. It will take about 50 minutes, and it's entitled A Better Way to Fund Transportation. I'd like to give you a little background, because this thing will do two things that people haven't thought about. Because this legislature years ago gave a really special powerful advantage to one business in this state over every other business. This bill will also fund transportation, will also equalize that. And one thing I want to really bring up to your attention, on the chart here, on your left-hand side, you'll see a little tiny 1957 foot, the total debt of this nation was then. And if you look over here now, 2007, it's right up to $53 trillion. On the one to the left, the red line shows how fast the debt is going up. The one to the on the bottom, the blue line, shows you what the national income is going up. Now, this is clearly not a sustainable, it just can't be done. I mean, you can't keep going that direction forever. And several years ago, I became aware of this and started thinking about it, and my thoughts was, how in the world could you get this much debt, $53 trillion debt, when you do nothing but produce wealth? And I asked the president of the Minnesota Bankers Association several years ago if he could name me anything that's not created as an asset, and he said, everything is. And I said, how could you possibly get this much debt? And he didn't have much of an answer. So when I started to think about this, I started to research it, and I wrote letters to the United States Treasury and others. And Russell Monk wrote the answer to the first one, and my question was, how is, went up one too many. There we go. And Russell Monk answered the question, and he said, my question was, how is money actually created inside our system? And he wrote back to me and said, the actual creation of money always involves the extension of credit from a private commercial bank. If we don't borrow, there is no money. Then Mr. Monk went on to say, you may want to know whether the bank is the one getting the benefit of the new money. Since the bank creates all the new money, the bank does get indeed the benefit. And we should all get the benefit of our production, not just one entity. My next question was, I borrowed a lot of money in my life, and obviously when you borrow, you just get what you borrowed, and then the interest kicks in, your debt grows, but not your money. So I asked him, well, where does the interest come from to pay on all this debt? And he wrote back and said, well, that comes from the same source the other money comes from. In other words, you have to borrow that, too. You have to go back to the bank and borrow. We have to borrow to get the money, and then we have to borrow to pay the interest on the money. Now, in the long term, this is clearly unsustainable and very impossible to work in the end. John Yetter, in another letter later on, said, well, the money one borrowers used to pay interest on a loan has been created somewhere else in the economy by another loan. That means every generation has to get deeper in debt than the last one to keep our system going, and that can't go on either. Our kids can't handle this. I've asked several legislators in this down here, and if they really believe their kids could function under three times as much of the debt as they have, and the answer every time was no. And so, John Henderson, senior price specialist for the Library, Congressional Research Service Library, answered my question and said, well, money is created when loans are issued and debt incurred. Money is extinguished when the loan is repaid. So if you pay the loan, the money goes out of circulation and doesn't exist for somebody else to borrow it. Robert Hemphill from Federal Reserve Bank Atlanta said, if all the bank loans are paid, there would not be a dollar of coin or currency in circulation or no money in anybody's checking account. So we proposed a much better way to do this, and that's what 619 and, of course, the companion bill word for word in the Senate, which we have a hearing on the 27th. And this bill is a very unique and innovative way to approach this funding shortfall, and it will provide not only safe and sound roads for Minnesota, but it will also provide a safer and sounder banking system than we have right at the moment. And anybody that has just listened to the news in the last 3 weeks know that we're not as sound as we ought to be. And this bill will do this by enhancing a current practice that the bankers have but don't use much. And that is creating money as an asset instead of just as an investment instead of just creating it as a loan. And here is I'm not going to go through this completely, but here's an email. I contacted the FDIC and asked them if banks could create money as an investment. And he said, yes, they can. And I said, well, what would be the controlling factor? And he said, well, that's a very tough question. It all depends whether it's a federal bank or a state bank or what. And I said, well, let's just stick with state banks. What would be the controlling factor there? And he said, well, that would be whatever the state law says. And I said, would that be binding on FDIC? And he said, yes, on their audit. And so that's where we start. Now we get into the bill. And this bill is a simple bill. It's a conceptual bill that will make just the whole economy in Minnesota grow, as well as having safe and sound the roads. And what it will do is mandate the state and the state charter banks to enter into an agreement whereby the banks will invest in the needed transportation projects of this state. The banks will do this by buying the natural equity, and the state will maintain the user's rights. Here's how it works. Now, State Bank, under this time, under this agreement they will write up will buy the natural equity rights, and they will then monetize that or turn it into money, just the way they do now, your promissory note when you go to the bank. They will just simply create it and turn it into money. The bank will then enter this into an asset monetization account, or it could be called anything, and that at that point in time, the value of that road will turn into money. It's that simple, and I know this shocks a lot of people's minds because they've never really spent the time thinking about how the system works. This process will then, and down here we put in a figure what actually took to build 12 miles of 394 some years back. The bank will then debit the money electronically out of the asset monetization account and credit to the state transportation account. And therefore, the money will just move from one account to the other, and then from there on, the state will pay out and pay the contractors just exactly the way they do now. Nothing else in the whole system will change except the origin of the money. From then on, the contractor will pay the bill just like he does now according to the rules of the contract, and we've all heard that discussed all afternoon. The road workers will get paid, and they'll spend their money into the economy, and so will the equipment workers and raw materials providers. This money will then flow into the Minnesota economy when each one of them goes out and buys their food, their housing, their transportation, and make their bank money. You will see several benefits here. You know, we've named them. Also, I think we really need to get back to real basics here, because the government, according to the Minnesota Transportation, was clearly instituted for the security, the benefit, and the protection of the people. And we really don't believe the state has done that in the long run, because they have not obviously provided enough transportation money, otherwise we wouldn't have bridges falling down and bridges, and, you know, closed down because they're afraid they're going to fall down. And you just can't, the state cannot provide benefits to people when they constantly increase their taxes or constantly increase their bonded indebtedness. Right now, the state of Minnesota, if you combine all the school boards and the cities and counties and everything, have over a $29 billion indebtedness in a state that probably has as much natural resources as any state in the union. And also, the state is not really providing protection for the people when they have a system where they allow one small entity to create all the money for their own personal profit and not also create the money for the benefit of all the people. Because that's what we need. We can't be forced into constantly growing debt just to have a medium exchange. And this bill will do all these things. It will give us a greater economy. It will give us fairness and honesty in our transactions. It will have the state banks provide a benefit to the state and everybody in it, as well as having a profit for themselves, and I'm not against profits for anybody. We all know how badly our roads and bridges that need upgraded, updated, and rebuilt. We believe by passing this unique and innovative bill, it will help you to fulfill all your constitutional duties that you have to provide the security and protection of the people of Minnesota and provide them the best road system you can have. And with that, I will close that, because I told you I'd do it in 15 minutes, and I think I've come awful close, and I hope I've made a lot of sense. And you have absolutely no risk in passing this bill and moving it forward. You have absolutely no downside. You have absolutely nothing to lose, and you have the world to gain. You can do more for this state by this bill than anything else you've done. And with that, I close, and I thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Are there questions of the committee? It would appear to me we'd have to change a lot of state statutes to allow the banks to do this. Because right now we can bond.
No, you don't have to change a single thing except one little thing that's in this bill. and just have them go ahead and practice what they can do anyway, and that's create money as an investment. You don't have to change any tax bills. You don't have to do anything. Now, if you really wanted to, you could probate this so that the state banks wouldn't have to pay near as much taxes. You could do it on a sliding scale, and I talked a lot about with this about Tom Pinder, that they get a credit for so much money this, it could reduce their tax bill, which would also help them. But other than that, you really don't need to do anything else because it doesn't affect anything. The banks already have this power to create money as investments. We clearly know that from personal conversations with the FDIC. So all you have to do is see that it's implemented.
Representative Drew, you had a question?
I did.
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chair.
To the testifier, remind us again, do the states still have a right to coin their own money, and would, under your proposal, do you see these as being Federal Reserve notes or denominated in Federal Reserve units?
They'll be denominated in what we use right now as dollars, which there is no definition of any place in the United States or any other state law that declares what a dollar is. And I know that for a fact. I can prove it beyond it, but I don't have time here. No, that will not affect any of that. This money will be checkbook money only. It will be created inside the books of the banks, and it will stay there just like it does now. Believe it or not, I'm old enough to get Social Security, and I do. I haven't had a bank account for years, and when I got that check, there was absolutely no way I could get any benefit out of it without having a bank account. I would endorse it over to my wife, full endorsement, she deposited in the bank. They would, the next day, she'd get credit, the next day, they'd be taken off the credit, and I would get the check back until I got a checking account. This money will work just like that. It'll create it in the checking account, it'll stay in the checking account, and it'll just move from checking account to checking account. I have spent more time working on this than you people can probably even imagine. Because when I heard the Senate Transportation said, we have got to find a better way, I knew that I had the experience and the know-how to provide that better way.
Any further questions? If not, Chair will renew his motion that House File 619 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary?
No.
No.
House File 619 does not pass. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
The next two bills, Representative Nador and Representative Slocum, will hear those tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And House File 3805 is not Representative Leader, that's Representative Morrow. But it deals with the budget, which we have to pass, supposedly we have to pass by tomorrow. Is there a handout, you see?
No.
Representative Morrow, do you want to, he's actually just moved the bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Leader. I would move the DE1 amendment to House File 3805, which members should have.
Do you not?
Yeah. I'm sorry, she passed that right now, members. I apologize.
Representative Moore, if that's okay, I'll have Representative, or not Representative, but Mr. Brewer.
That'd be Mr. great. Brewer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is basically the transportation portion of the state supplemental budget. We had to make reductions, as is pointed out in this amendment, and the only reductions we can make is with the general fund monies. And as you know, we don't have much general fund monies. We only have some general fund monies in rural transportation and in public safety, basically. The rest are all trunk highway funds. So Mr. Burr is working with that, and with the little, we couldn't make, we really couldn't touch small accounts. It was $30,000 or $40,000. Some of them were small in public safety. And we were supposedly, we were given a target of $200,000 to reduce in 2009 and 2010, I think we had the same target. Well, anyhow, Representative, or Mr. Corinne Zuer is probably going to explain it. The fiscal analyst. This is how we're making adjustments to meet the supplemental budget.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, what I'll do is I'll just walk quickly through the spreadsheet because I think most of the elements in the bill are included in the spreadsheet. As you can see, there are reductions to the various general fund appropriations, and they include a 0.1% decrease for Greater Minnesota Transit, in fiscal year 09, and then just a little bit higher than 0.1%. I believe it's 0.11% in fiscal years 2010 and 2011. With freight, there's a 0.5% decrease, and we use 0.5% on all of the items besides the transit pieces of the budget. State roads, the item under the state road construction is federal funds for bridges that was requested in the governor's budget bill for $6.8 million. As you can see, for...
We don't reduce any of that. That's trunk highway funds.
That's trunk highway funds, and that's an increase in spending authority rather than a decrease. The Met Council budget is decreased by approximately 0.12% in fiscal 09 and 0.15% in fiscal years 10 and 11. And then for the Department of Public Safety, the decreases come in public safety support, capital security, and those two pieces. And one additional decrease besides the 0.5% general fund is also a decrease recommended by the governor, which is $28,000 for the security coordinator for the Republican National Convention.
That was also, Ms. Lewis, that was also in the governor's recommended
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Under driver and vehicle services, there's a trunk highway fund appropriation for $12 million in fiscal 09 and then $12 million in 10 and 11 as well. For the redesign of the DVS computer system, and this was recommended in the governor's budget as well. And to bring us to the target that was discussed in the Ways and Means Committee today, the last decrease is of the in the value capture study appropriation, which was included in Chapter 152, which was passed earlier this year. The other language in the bill is focuses on two revenue items. One is a repeal of special license surcharge, and then the second is around a reinstatement fee for controlled substance for licenses. And with both of those, they were recommended in the governor's supplemental budget as well.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any questions on why we made the cuts, the suggested cuts? We have a low target. Supposedly, every division is supposed to cut 4% in general funds. Well, if we'd have cut 4% in our general funds, we wouldn't have anything left, basically.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
Quick question about what the definition of the freight account is. Is that what we pay FedEx for hauling our stuff around, or is that actually to the freight desk that deals with ports and railroads and so on at MnDOT?
Ms. Stewart.
And will that affect the Mercy program, for instance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, that is for the freight, the second, like you suggested.
And it's only 2,000. Is this 2,000 or 2 million? 2,000?
2,000.
Well, okay, never mind. Mr. Chairman, I'm looking all through here to find the aeronautics department being cut. Thank you. I don't see it anywhere.
They flew out.
Excuse me. Thank you to Representative Morrow for not coming.
Are there any questions, further questions from the committee? If not, this bill will be goes to the finance committee. For Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm very, very appreciative that the way out of proportion cut that the governor proposed for transit of something like $26 million is not here, and I think that 94,000, not ideal, but I think hopefully the administration of the Met Council can absorb that. But my understanding is this would not affect bus system operations in terms of a fare increase or any of the other draconian things that would have been prompted by the governor's proposal. Is that correct? Maybe Mr. Shetman could comment on that.
Okay. And two, if you look, Representative Hornstein, we really tried to avoid about 1,200. Well, Mr. Shetman. Representative Hornstein apparently thought you should testify.
Well, Representative Leader and members, I'll be very, very short. I apologize, I didn't hear all of Representative Hornstein's comments, but he was asking, is it just, I understand that this $94,000 just pertains to our general fund. We also have an MVEST shortfall there, which would be an additional like $14.5
million.
And that is not included here in the general fund reduction. You're right, that there was a like a $26 million one-time reduction plus a 4% ongoing general fund, which is equivalent to about $3.2 million. That is addressed in the House target number. So the $14.5 million and the MVEST is not. And that's all.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
These numbers, then, do they accomplish the target that the administration was asking for?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the target. No, that's a target that they set. It's our target. In here. It's our target from Ways and Means, Representative Beard.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's not the administration, but what yeah. Ways and Means is asking. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Representative Morrow will renew his motion at House File 3805 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Division. As amended, that's right. Where do we? Yeah, as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. House File 3805 is on its way to Finance. Now, for the members, tomorrow we have, we're going to continue this bill until we represent Kalen's bill and represent Senator Medore and Representative Slocum. So it shouldn't be too, except for Kalen's, it shouldn't be too long. Kalen said he's going to do it in a half hour today.
Mr. Chair, you'll note that I and my testifiers were very, very brief.
And I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions. So room 5 tomorrow at 2:15. The meeting is adjourned.